Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Kia ora e te whanau. Welcome to Caucus. It's the last one before the election, guys. 55 hours until the polls close.
Get it out, Julia.
We can say it. We're recording this about Thursday lunchtime, so whenever you're listening, please take that into account. Whew, deep breath, everybody. How are you feeling?
Well, it's not our first rodeo.
Rodeo.
Right, okay, whatever. Well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, it's heating up. I would argue there's still lots to play for. Two polls recently.
Two polls.
Showing trends that arguably the right bloc will not be thrilled with.
No.
I think there's one person who'll be incredibly happy. Trotting potentially back into Parliament, or galloping, depending on whose numbers you believe.
Bit of variation. One News had National Act 58 seats, News Hub 54. So a 3 or 4 seat disagreement between the two polls that came out last night from News Hub and One News. But the trends and the implications are pretty similar, aren't they?
Oh, they are, which is, on these polls, it would be a centre-right government, but one that would require Winston Peters and all the instability that National itself has claimed would go with that. So one of the big failures that National will look back on is its handling of Winston Peters over this campaign, because they have breathed life into his campaign. And if they are saddled with the issues of Winston Peters, then they've only got themselves to blame.
Well, Chris Bishop disagrees with you.
People, I think, have overread that decision, as you put it, a little bit, because actually what we were doing is just making it clear and being upfront and transparent with New Zealanders about what our preferred governing arrangements were post-election. Consider the flip side, where both major party leaders say they're not willing to pick up the phone and talk to Mr. Peters and New Zealand First. Well, fundamentally, actually, we would have spent much of the election campaign talking about that anyway. So you're kind of damned if you do, or you're damned if you don't.
It's disingenuous, in my view, from
not overreading it.
Because, you know, it's like me saying, well, you know, a nuclear war could happen. I mean, if I'm a really powerful leader and I say that, then that has some resonance.
Yeah.
You know, of course, it's always a possibility. But to go and say the quiet bit out loud, as Chris Bishop did, they breathed life into his campaign by doing that.
And this is not just the we will pick up the phone and talk to Winston Peters if we have to moment, but this past weekend, the second election, the 8 weeks of negotiations, right?
Yeah, I think what they tried to do was wedge Winston Peters, and they actually ended up wedging ACT.
This is a party that was on 13-14%. Exactly right. Who's going to
suffer from this? And is now on 9% one poll and 8% whatever it is in another poll. And so it's actually ended up, and look, ACT can be responsible. David Seymour has not had a good campaign. In fact, I think it's been the worst campaign out of this campaign, to be honest with you, from a party. He has not performed well. And in one of the minor leaders debates, he came across as petulant and childish, in my view, and that's really hurt them. But they actually tried to wedge Winston, and it hasn't paid off, and I think they're going to regret that decision. They waited too long, first of all. Then when they finally said, well, we'll pick up the call, but we want New Zealanders not to go with Winston, and we're going to get John Key out, it's actually made things worse. Winston's now, what is he, 6-1 and over 6-1? And it's actually hurt
ACT. I think one of them was. Yeah, 6.6. Yeah. I think, you know, some people may think otherwise, but if you're looking for a MVP on the election trail, it's Winston Peters, because he has appeared like a statesman this week, in the sense that he has said, they shouldn't be scaring the voters like that. I will form a government. I won't send people back to the polls. He has sounded very much like the voice of reason. And obviously the ads that National ran, which were plugging the uncertainty and said 8 weeks or whatever it was, unable to make decisions, you know, basically presenting this picture will be frozen in time. The 8 weeks is back from 1996, right? Coalition negotiations then. And he was fast to say, actually, it took me, what did it take? 14 days? last time.
Yeah.
Took me 14 days.
He's got better as he's got older, eh?
Yeah.
He's speeding up as he gets.
But, you know, he's
14 hours this time.
He has run a completely different narrative in juxtaposition to what's been coming out of Nationals campaign camps.
I guess,
and he's looking incredibly reasonable.
Yeah, I'd agree with most of what you guys have said on that. The one qualification and one doubt in my mind is when people go into the booth on Saturday and remember that advance voting is well down on what we saw last time. Now, it was a COVID election, but we saw 1.9 million advanced votes before the 2020 yep. election, and it's sitting at about 800,000 as of today,
yeah,
something like that. Okay,
yep.
So it's well down, and so there's still quite a bit to play for. I just wonder whether some of that, what they call the quiet Tory effect, might occur on the weekend, where all of this mayhem that has been stirred up, and we've talked about how that's damaged National, will some of that just wash over and people will fear in uncertainty and go into a sort of a flight to safety for National? I'm not talking about a big surge,
no.
But they may yet reap some of that reward. So
it's that word people, isn't it? Because we're talking about percentages, right? It's only a few percentage here and there who have to feel a certain way, whether like, nah, let's get Winston to stick it to them, or yeah, actually that's a bit destabilising. But it's not everybody having to think that way. It's only a few percent.
That's right. So we're just not quite sure whether some of that, those warnings about mayhem may actually pay off for enough of their voters. They'll still be hoping for that.
Well, yeah. You mentioned 1996. Let's just play, because you spoke to Mr. 1996 Jim Bolger this week.
I did.
And he took a much calmer approach to than the current National Party did.
I don't expect that to happen. I expect the leaders of the parties who are the majority after next Saturday's election to form the government, and no particular reason why they won't. I don't think the conditions are very difficult to form a deal.
Take that, Chris Bishop.
And I mean, he should know that there was such, you know, water. There was a tsunami of crap under that bridge before they came to sit down to negotiate.
You know, I will not be in a government with
Jim
Bolger.
I won't sit at the cabinet table with blah, blah,
blah.
That was Tohinere who said that. But he was part of the party. He was the number two at the top.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And they had both said...
And Peters was still openly hostile as part of, you know...
Oh, yeah, everyone thought he was going to go with Labour.
Yeah.
Although, if you read the Demon Provision, and I'm pretty sure I'm only one of 10 people who has, by Michael Laws, but Michael Laws said he was always going to go with National, but what changed the course of that negotiation, what changed the trajectory of the decision in the end, was the respect that Bolger afforded him after the election, the way in which they engaged, which then meant that they could smoke the peace pipe.
Right.
Is that going to happen with David Seymour and Chris Luxon, given what's happened?
Yeah. Now, he's third party in the mix does change things, right?
Mix,
yeah, that's a good point. It
depends on how those parties line up, though. Who's going to be...
Who's number two and who's number three?
Who's number two and who's number three? And
That's a very good point.
That is going to be an essential part.
Could
New Zealand First really pass ACT?
It's possible, yeah.
Well, back to Guyon's point, I think Guyon's right. I think when people get into the Tory effect of the polling booth, I think the decision is going to be, should I take the safe bet with National, or if I really want to stick it to Labour and the left, I'll go with Winston. I don't think it's an ACT decision in the middle.
No.
I think it's a National or Winston decision, or New Zealand First decision, not ACT in the middle, which means it could have an impact on the night with ACT, who... slowly but surely dropping down in the poll.
And the trend is not their friend at the moment with the ACT Party. And as we know and have discussed many times before, if you look back at polls and how Winston Peters in New Zealand First does in the ultimate poll, election day, he tends to do better than he does on paper. Whereas the Greens, they lose 1% to 2%.
Theory of the guy that could be different this time. That's an interesting thought to see. But some of that quest for stability vote might even be crossing the boundaries, right? And actually coming back to Labour a little bit, to just for people who are a little bit concerned about the whole idea of this National-led coalition?
I don't know. I think the reason why the Greens are so high at 15%, one, they've had a very good campaign. I thought James Shaw did pretty well when he was standing next to David Seymour in the minor leaders debate that Jack Tame facilitated, where he just gave him quips after quips, and David Seymour just looked lost. Manama Davidson, who I think has been the best leader in the whole campaign, actually, I think, particularly in the press debate, there were moments where the applause for her was...
We'll come, we'll come, we'll come, let's come, come,
but yeah. come back to it. Yeah. I think that the I don't think that middle vote is actually going to Labour. I think why Labour's so low is a lot of it is actually going to the Greens.
They're cannibalising each other. Labour's stuck in the mud.
And you mentioned, Julian, before about whether, you know, National made its call too late and so forth. I just wonder, you know, National can only speculate, but what if this speech from Chris Luxon in May, remember, in May, was a bit different?
Today I've ruled out National coming to any arrangement with Te Pāti Māori and forming a government after this year's election.
What if he'd added New Zealand First?
Well, I think that that was going to be the second leg of the double, and then they bottled out on it, and then hoped he would go away, and then you sort of got that pantomime situation.
That was another horse metaphor.
He's behind you. No, he's not, is he? Yes, he is. Oh my God, it's too late.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the things is, like, as we've talked about before, Key used to do it in February of an election year. Mm. Here are the parties we're going to work with. And what you don't do is, it's all about timing, right? And Peters knows timing and politics better than anyone. And I'm wearing the pinstripe suit today in honour of him.
In tribute.
But so what you don't do is go out in the heat of an election campaign and say, oh, if I had to, I would pick up the call and make that call. Again, it's axiomatic. It's self-evident that you would have to. But if you've said it out loud, some of your voters hear, oh, Luxon said that I can vote for Winston. Yeah. That's what some Conservative voters may well have taken from
it. They didn't go the whole nine yards. And it's as we discussed before, the analogy that Guyon used was the half-pie bungee jump where you'll whack yourself on the tower on the way down. And I think that is exactly right. You have to fully commit or you don't.
It was part of the waka strategy where you have one waka going straight in a direction and the other one going around and around in circles, which John Key and Stephen Joyce deployed so successfully against Labour. So the idea was, remember, when we talk about coalition of chaos, remember, it was supposed to be, National was supposed to be on the left, and so they were going to rule out these other guys and say, it's going to be National and we're going to be the stable guys. Yeah. It's utterly rebounded on them, and the coalition of chaos is undoubtedly on the right now.
But they obviously thought, the calculation, what Bishop was saying before, he said that they were damned if they do and damned if they don't. Presumably, the argument amongst the Nats at that point was, if we block them out, they will become martyrs and they will get the oxygen anyway. We're not going to be able to win either way, so we're just going to try and ignore them.
That's partially correct, although we knew when they started getting it close to 5% that the race was on.
Yeah.
And to take the horse racing analogy to a ridiculous conclusion, I think National forgot Kiwi in 1984 in the Melbourne Cup.
Kiwi's come for the big
and that's Winston. Winston, when he's on close to 5% a month out from an election, always comes storming home.
Regardless of your call, make it early.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
You cannot breathe life into his campaign at the last minute.
But if they had made that different call, I know this is a bit of a what if, but what do you think? If they had made that different call in May, he'd said no Te Pāti Māori and no New Zealand First. Peters had already ruled out Labour last year. Would that have walled New Zealand First off?
I think to a degree, because the media and a lot of people would have been going, well, he's not really in the race this time. And the only way to deal with Peters, if you don't want him, is to ignore him.
Yeah.
That's the only way to deal with him. Now, he may well have come out of the box. He's amazing at gaining his own publicity and things. Who knows? But I think there would be a reasonable chance if both of them had said, look, oh, we're not going to deal with him in government, then he's a player and he may well not have got that momentum.
Yeah.
But then this is the difference, I think, between National in 2023 and National in 2014 under a Key government. Because if you're going to rule both of them out, and that's where your thinking's at, who's the next best option? You go for a Kahurangi Green. Yeah. and you try and back up your option, but of course they'd already decided no coalition of chaos on the left. We simply can't do anything with the Greens. Mm. They're part of the Māori Party. We're going to stitch them over there, which worked in the first couple of weeks. But then they didn't have a backup, and that's the problem.
But that goes against the entire narrative that everyone is speaking, which is you deal with what the voter gives you. So if you deal with what the voter gives you, then if you don't have a pathway to power, unless you go and talk to some of those parties who are not your natural home, then why is it you're prepared to talk to one that's not your natural home in New Zealand First, but you're not prepared to talk to the
Well
to
it
the,
doesn't make any sense yeah. now, I agree. Yeah,
so that policy doesn't make any sense at all, you either don't talk to any of them and hold your ground, and then basically you're going for a first-past-the-post model under an MMP.
Sure, but the answer to that is that it's chicken and egg, yeah. right? You're not just waiting for the voters to speak. You're actually trying to encourage the voters to speak in a certain way.
And the one thing we haven't said, and I think Labor deserves credit for this, because they ruled out New Zealand First. Now, at the time, it did seem a bit ridiculous.
They'd already ruled them out.
I know, but this is what I was going to say. It does sound ridiculous because New Zealand First had already ruled Labor out. But what that did was fling the dead rat back at everyone else at the right.
Yeah, it did.
And so at that point, the discussion was, oh, well, we've ruled them out, and it gave it a new burst, and the media were all over that. And so it flung the problem to the right, and they were throwing this ball around not knowing what to do with it, which is why we've got this chaos. And they strategically did not adapt to what Labor had done.
So the reverse to the question that Tim likes to ask is, well, should Chris Hipkins have done that? Because now he's backed himself into a corner.
Yeah,
in the same way you ask whether National should have gone harder earlier and ruled out Winston Peters, well, now if you look at the polls that we have in front of us, there would be a pathway if they could use New Zealand First. And I think it's an interesting narrative that Chris Bishop is still running as of a couple of hours ago.
I mean, if we could switch from horses to cats, I mean, imagine trying to herd that bunch. You know, Labour, Te Pāti Māori, Green and New Zealand First.
Have you heard Chris Bishop this morning saying, still with that,
he'll still pick up the phone.
But
the difference again that was that Winston Peters and New Zealand First had not only already ruled out Labour, they had done it in such a way. And let's play this clip because it's been on the website for months now, and this has been under the label "Our Commitment to You."
In this election, our commitment to you is:
New Zealand First will not return Labour to power,
whether in coalition or in confidence and supply.
I mean, it was just, there was nothing for Labour to go, really. I mean, could they ever pick up the phone even now?
Yeah.
With that kind of commitment, there's no way, is there?
Let's be honest. Labour's problems are not because it ruled out New Zealand First. It's because it doesn't have the policies that appeal to the traditional Labour voting base to get it to 33% to make it competitive. But ruling him out means that they've essentially assured that there is going to be a government on the right.
That's me being rude. You go.
All I was going to say was if you're a part of Labour now, you go, oh, well, you know, we might not get there because there's a coalition of the right, and yes, it is a coalition of chaos that becomes a government. You're kind of also thinking, geez, let's just let this play out and see what happens over the next 3 years.
Well,
because we could have only a one-turn government if this thing implodes, which it might do.
Let's talk a bit about the left, because you said, you know, Labour didn't have the policies, and I think it's a fair critique to talk policy. But really, didn't Labour lost this in June and August when its ministers all packed up and fell apart, right? I mean, this is a Stuart Nash, Michael Wood, Kitty Allen loss.
And remember, on top of all the COVID angst and the embers of our lockdowns and real fear about violent crime and an economy that was, maybe wasn't quite in recession, but was not doing very well, and a cost of living crisis. Now, so if you look at those things, crime and the economy and just a, you know, on the wrong track sort of direction, then National should be romping.
And the right track, wrong track polls have been in National's favour for over a year now, so you would have thought, it's a fair point. I just think with all of this stuff, it's interesting to think that National made that call in May and in many ways, you know, influenced where we are now. Labour fell apart in July and August.
It started earlier when they started talking about bread and butter, even though they knew it was going to be a cost of living election. When they started talking about bread and butter, ran for the centre, didn't actually stick to their true DNA and started doing things like a wealth tax, which they kept teasing the country with and then never did, that's when they started losing.
Right. And so Labour now is running, well, look at it, Mike Moore talked about saving the furniture right in 1990, and Hipkins is basically running the 2026 campaign now, isn't he?
Save our souls.
He's fighting for the next election.
Because if you look at the raw numbers, right, and we can't know the exact configuration because it depends on who wins the electorate seats and all the rest of it. But based on the fact that they got 50% of the vote at the last election and they're polling, let's say, between 25 and 28%, give or take, you know, which polls you believe, you're shedding half of your MPs. So, you know, they've got, depending on if you count departures, what, 60, 65, they lost one to a by-election, and then Jacinda, I don't know, does she still count in that until she's not there anymore?
Well, let's just, talking about whether Jacinda still counts, let's play this.
Okay.
But some people have asked me what my opinion is. And I have no hesitation in sharing that. The opinion that I hold, if anyone indeed needed to be reminded of it, it is to just think about the future and the future that you want for New Zealand and keep it simple. And if you voted for me in 2017, well, thank you for that. But that probably meant you were also voting for issues like poverty and climate change and inequality and housing. And the Labour Party has had two terms in office, long enough to make progress, not long enough to finish the job.
It's been a long year, hasn't it? I mean, she was the leader at this year, the beginning of this
but
year.
I think that's why the campaign feels so long, because it started when she she raised her hand and said, I'm off ski, right? It basically was game on from that point, because people saw a political opportunity and they went for it.
But she's, I mean, it was interesting, she started her video exactly, the almost like word for word with what John Key started his, right? People have been wondering what I would vote for, but my understanding is we haven't really.
It's no surprise. And I don't think either of them are going to do their party's cause
much
good.
I don't think she wanted to be involved in that.
I found that video strange, very strange. Just even the tone of it, very strange. Like, you're either all in for an endorsement or you're not. And it was kind of like the old, I'm not telling you what to do, sort of. And it's hard to get the tone right, because as Guyon was saying, people don't like to be told, instructed, and you don't want to appear like you're begging.
She felt a long way away, didn't
she? Yeah, you don't want to be begging with your cap out either. But I don't know, the tone of it just didn't seem right. And it was sort of what was like this weird intrusion into the campaign almost as well.
No, I agree with you. I think
all the baggage too, doesn't it?
I think both of them, John Key and Jacinda, I didn't think both of their videos were great, to be honest with you. You kind of, if you're Labour, you wanted Helen Clark thumping the table. You know, you want, come
telling
on.
Telling you what to
come
do.
Come on, the old Leaguey fan going, come on, up the Lars, not up the Wars. And that's not what we've seen. And yeah, it feels a little bit like they both got dragged into a scenario they didn't really want to be a part of.
But presumably she's got a whole bunch of mates going, save my seat.
You know,
if you can get me an extra 1%, that's potentially another 2. Like, when are we, some guys, unnamed political consultants have been doing some numbers on this. And if you look at, they got to, working from the polls last week, they got to about an 18% party swing if you did some maths around the difference between the two major parties last election and the two major parties now. And you're talking about, if you are looking at anything like a 16, 17, 18% swing away from Labour to National, then it really is blue wave territory. And you're putting, you know, not just the Northlands, which we know are probably in trouble, and Mangakekia, which is, you know, probably gone, and all of those and upper harbours and stuff, but, you know, Te Atatū, Dunedin, which has only been not been Labour once since 2025, Christchurch Central, Geoffrey Palmer's old seat. I mean, these are heartland red seats which are now potentially in play electorally. That's quite something. And this is, you know, let's maybe start talking about the seats we're going to watch, because I know you want to talk about this, Julian. But man, I'm looking at Wairarapa and West Coast now, because can Damien O'Connor survive? Can Kieran McEnulty survive?
Well, Wairarapa is always one that you would look at. All those red wave seats, the so-called red wave seats, the ones that had National MPs in them and got scooped up in the massive victory of 2020. You'd always be watching those. But yeah, Wairarapa, Mangakekia, that's Priyanka Radhakrishnan, the West Harbour.
Who was only, what, about 16th on the list, so could go easily?
The West Harbour seat, again, all of those ones. Even, I mean, you'll be watching Wellington Central like a hawk, won't you?
Yep, that's one of the seats that I was going to talk about later on, but absolutely, and I don't think it's going to go blue either. I said a couple of weeks ago I thought it was going to go green. I don't know if I'm going to get anywhere near it, but anyway, at least I put my thing on the line for that. But you've got one, so if you think of 18%, like Wigram, which is Megan Woods, I mean, that's a new development, particularly after Christchurch earthquake. Lots of Asians actually in Wigram. It's a new development area. Lots of good shopping and movie theatres and things like that. Now, you would think that would be a really, and it's got places like Saltburn, which are traditionally Labour strongholds, that's up for grabs potentially. You know, Christchurch Central is up for grabs potentially as well. I mean, you look at ones like Mana, the thinking that if an 18% swing or just over goes against Labour, Mana could be up. You'd
I mean,
never
just think about insane that previous. But it's interesting. What were the other seats that you were interested
well,
in?
Well, look, there are seats that traditionally you would think would be bellwether seats and close. So I looked at ones like Northcote. You know, I had some interest in places like Wataki. I think both of those are gone, to be honest. I think Nash is going to take
Wataki's those. Going to the helicopter pilot, is
it? Look, I think so. I remember Nathan Guy stood in that seat. It was originally Darren Hughes.
Yes, Darren Hughes, then Nathan Guy.
Government, and then Nathan Guy. And it's always kind of predicted who the government's going to be. I think that seat's gone, even though Chris Hipkins did a bit of campaigning there at the beginning of this week. I think that's gone. I think there's some really close seats. Auckland Central's going to be a really interesting seat. Mm-hmm. And National's got a massive ground campaign in Auckland Central. And that potentially could go, you know, Chloe Swarbrick has a huge profile and is very present in Auckland Central, but that could go national as well. Wellington
that's
Central.
Your point about crime, right? I mean, that's interesting. Yeah. Auckland Central.
Wellington Central as well.
I think that's absolutely right. And they have been making a big, big deal of that. Not so much recently, have they, in the last few weeks. I thought they would keep hammering that home, but it has been a big part of their campaign and it will be a big part of the worry in Auckland Central, especially among small business owners. You talk a lot of small business owners. They are very worried about that. And they don't think the government's done enough. So it is interesting to see National's candidate nipping at Chloe Swarbrick's heels.
Look, I still think she's going to win it. That's again, I'll put my thing on the line here. And I'm wary that we've got some people watching me at the moment who are writing all this down to prove me wrong on the night. But I think Chloe will win it. I do think Wellington Central is definitely up for grabs. And I think Tamantha Paul, who's the candidate for the Green Party there, has a huge profile through her work in Wellington Council. I think she could potentially take that seat. And I'll say she will win that seat. But the fact that those ones aren't competitive, not for Labour, and then Labour seats that are held at the moment that could be up for grabs is not good signs for Labour at all. They need 30.
Which is my point about the 2026 election, right, is that they are now fighting to actually preserve their leadership and their, you know, potential cabinet in 3, 6, 9 years' time.
But also in some of those Māori seats, they're you know, putting all of it down on one number, because even Calvin Davis, I was interested in this morning, was saying that if he does not win his seat, even though he is number two on the list, he said that's it, it's tapping out. We told one media outlet this morning, he either wins or he's a gone burger.
The long-term impacts on Labour here are huge. You could lose someone like Willow Jean Prime, who, if
she's
she doesn't win
Northland...
I
think she's on the list. Yeah. Let's check what you're talking.
Willie Jackson potentially goes if they stay on 26. Yep. You know, Adrian Rudafe. You lose
Andrew
someone...
Little, like, David Parker.
Andrew, Kieran McAnulty as well, and Wairarapa might not make it in particularly on the list as well. If he doesn't win Wairarapa, you're talking about the future leadership of the party. Mm. And in particular in the Māori electorates, Kelvin, you know, this is fourth-ish campaign, Nanaia Mahuta, who's got a close race apparently in Hauraki Waikato against Hana Rawhiti Mai.
And she's only standing in...
She's not on the list. So what you can see Labour trying to do is say do some strategic voting here. Vote for the Labour Party candidate, Kusha Tangaere and Ikuru Arafati, Sarai Peke Mason and Te Tai Hawaeru, and then party vote the Māori Party. You get both candidates, strong candidates in, because they're closely, hotly contested seats. But if some of those people don't make a bid in, there's your future leadership of the Māori.
The other factor, though, I guess, is that you've got some of those names we mentioned, the Labour Party could go, right, if they don't win. You say Kelvin Davis could tap out.
Yeah, well, that's what he was suggesting.
Presumably Grant Robertson could resign.
Grant Robertson,
number four.
And done his time, doesn't he?
And only on the list.
Does Aisha Vera want to be an opposition MP, or is she just really here for COVID? I don't know.
I'd imagine she would stick around.
Damien O'Connor, I think if he doesn't win West Coast, he could say, similar to Kelvin, that's enough.
Even having that comment, Damien O'Connor not winning West Coast. I mean, even thinking
he's
about
lost it before.
It, no, true. But having spent a bit of time on the West Coast when I was working in Lido, like he's a popular man down there. Yeah. But the fact that seat's up for grab just kind of blows my mind.
All right. We promised last week that we would get to the things that we thought were missing in this campaign, because I think this is interesting. We've had a pretty good look now at all the things that we could have possibly talked about. But what about the things we didn't talk about? What got underplayed this campaign? Who wants to go first?
I think I was surprised there wasn't more debate about immigration in this campaign, especially when you see, you know, record numbers like 96,000 net immigration.
96.
It's extraordinary. And we've angsted about it when it's been a lot less than that. And we've rightly asked questions about whether we have the infrastructure and how we treat our immigrants. I mean, there's been so many Labour, with a small L, scandals this year, and programs which have been abused. I'm just surprised that given the extent of those numbers that we haven't had a better debate about immigration. And I was quite amazed to see the guy who's campaigned against immigration for as long as I can remember, Winston Peters, actually say in the Christchurch press debate that the answer to the health crisis was immigration. So I guess part of it is that hangover from COVID when the borders were closed and now immigration is seen as a really positive thing, and that everyone's crying out for workers. So possibly that's why those numbers haven't alerted anyone. But, you know, those people are going to have to live somewhere, and they're
the
going to have to go to school somewhere, and they're going to have to drive on particular roads and flush sewage down particular pipes, which half of which is leaking into the Waitemata at the moment as we speak.
Yeah.
So New Zealand's infrastructure is in a grave state of disrepair, and I'm surprised there hasn't been more debate about that.
Yeah. You got something you wish we'd heard more about?
Well, do I wish we'd heard more about it or not? But I think we probably should have discussed it more, which is if these parties are going to be in government together, lining up their policies is going to be an interesting scenario, right? So looking at some of those policies, pulling out some of their policies and thinking, oh, well, that's interesting. How does that fit with their potential friends?
Yes.
I think is very interesting. Superannuation is obviously
one of
the ones that is massive, and although National's policy to raise the age of eligibility takes an eon, arguably,
very
to come
slow.
In, very slow, Winston Peters has built his political career on the gold card and looking after retirees for a start.
Yep.
So he's not going to want a bar of that, and there's not really been much of a discussion about where the halfway house is.
And ACT wants to start increasing the age next year.
Yes, and ACT wants to ramp up eligibility a lot faster. And separate to that, if one could trouble themselves to read the manifesto for New Zealand First, and I know, Guyon, you can borrow my copy after this.
I'm still looking for the costings.
Yes. Well, no, I got up to page 49. Sorry. Anyway,
but
page 21, for those people who are interested, tying into superannuation, is New Zealand's first policies around KiwiSaver, which I find really interesting. So they are talking about compulsory membership of KiwiSaver from your 18th birthday or when you become employed, restoring the kickstart payment from birth, and also tagging the government's contributions so that they're upped over time, some kind of tagging so that the government's contributions keep pace. So not only does he want this retirement, you know, payment, he wants you to get your super, he's talking about supercharging super, and that is indeed the word that he uses, supercharging KiwiSaver.
Well, he had a referendum on compulsory super
in
1998.
Yeah,
lost by 91.2%. I'm pretty sure. I could be wrong.
But you
Google it now. But it was the most clear-cut referendum I have ever seen in my life. And he lost.
And I don't think National has actually ruled it, been asked. It's a question I've been wondering. Have they actually ruled out cutting super contributions, which they wanted to do just a term ago?
Well, that is the question about that, because previous National governments have frozen.
Gone the other direction.
Yeah, frozen contributions.
While they paid off debt.
Yeah,
it was always an interesting argument whether it made sense.
Indeed.
You were borrowing $300 million.
But now is exactly the right time for that. Same, the National's making exactly the same argument, right? That we're getting back into surplus too slowly. We need to deal with debt. What do we do to stop debt? Super contributions is what they've gone to before.
Yeah, so my point is not just the disparity between the opinions on the current super situation.
Yeah.
He being Winston Peters in New Zealand First, one of their policies is to really ramp up KiwiSaver, which is obviously feeds into super and looking after yourself in retirement. And he's also suggesting that after your savings get past a certain amount, you should be able to draw it down to clear your mortgage. So, you know, I don't. Yeah. How are they going to marry that?
A lot to debate.
Let's see.
Look, I only have a couple. I'll be very brief. The constitutional lack of one constitutional arrangement in this country is an issue that's been bubbling away for years. Now, we've got a party that's talking about trying to have a referendum on the treaty and remove treaty principles. Mm. I think it requires a bit of a much bigger conversation that no one's actually talked about. Now, that actually may be a good thing. I'm not sure. But the fact that this has continued to have a conversation over many years and nothing much has happened probably requires a bit of a discussion at some time. It's probably a nice to have conversation rather than a need to have when you've got a cost of living election, but that's something that no one really talks about aside from if you want to get rid of the treaty. And then the other one was just on youth work skills development. You know, you had the unedifying spectacle of a 45-year-old representing the National Party in a youth debate. I mean, you know, in the words of Ray Purchase, I crap thee nay, 45 is not youth, and if it is, then I'm close, and I'm even, down with that.
It's not even youth adjacent, to quote someone we heard from a little earlier.
But, you know, I think there's been a distinct lack of how do we develop opportunities for youth employment, youth skills development, micro-credentialing, a change in the education system that deals with that, particularly in tertiary education, that hasn't been talked about a lot. Again, that might be because we are in a cost of living election and it's gone down the back burner a bit, but we're missing things here. And then the other thing, because it's the soup that we swim in, is given the merger isn't happening, and this may be too close to home, what the heck are we doing with broadcasting in this country going forward?
Mm. Well, you'd like to know that Winston would like a royal commission.
He also threatened Jack Tame in the Q&A interview
that he wants the broadcasting portfolio.
He might take the broadcasting portfolio I don't know, someone wanted to put him on Celebrity Treasure Island or something.
I think the...
Jack, rather than Winston.
Oh, yes, right, I was going to say. we'll jelly wrestle with Paddy Gower. Climate? We know we still haven't had a climate election in New Zealand. I feel like that's got to come some point in the next decade.
I know, but and I see Julian looking across the table at the Greens numbers there. I mean, is that the reason, part of the reason? I know Julian was saying, and I agree with him, that part of that is because Labor's been performing poorly, and that seesaw would mean the Greens are going up. But maybe it also does reflect concern that this is now a very mainstream issue, and what we've been through in 2023, and many of us have been in areas of the country which have flooded or been affected by cyclones, that part of that green support may well be that some of their big issues are coming home, and climate change may well be one of them.
Yeah, that's fair. But it's you're right. But it's in that growing a few percent thing. It doesn't feel like it's a big climate debate yet, right? The really hard stuff is still being kicked down the road a little bit. But it's a good point. It could be this. Maybe we don't have one big climate election. Maybe we just incrementally get there. But look, the main thing I and I want to pick up on your constitutional points and so forth is that we've right through the thread of this campaign has been this kind of co-governance constitutional stuff, but we've never had the grown up conversation yet, right? And I at a risk of pissing everybody off, you know, the majority of New Zealanders do not seem ready for co-governance in the form that three waters, council seats and so forth, you know, that there is clearly a big pushback around that, and some of that is from some pretty dark places. But some of it, you know, legitimate questions around democracy, right? And I think there's some really interesting, intelligent, smart debate to have there. On one hand, co-governance is not terrifying, right? That no democracy has ever been a pure one-person, one-vote situation. We have, in Canada, there are First Nations peoples that get votes. In America, there are different laws on reservations. In the UK, Welsh and Scottish people vote for a separate assembly. So the idea that co-governance in all kinds of forms is a terrifying, terrible thing is ridiculous. And historically here in New Zealand, for many years, Julian, you and I as a Pākehā man and you as a Māori man would have had very different gifts from the government, if you like. We would have had very different rights under different governments. And even today, my Māori children have access to things that I wouldn't have access to. But none of that is something to get hung up about. On the other hand, there are some questions around, you know, we have had also in the past century communism and fascism and totalitarianism and genuine threats to democracy. And so it seems to me legitimate for people to ask questions about how do we protect and safeguard democracy. And even, good Lord, look around the world right now, right? We have fewer and fewer liberal democracies left. So the people who are getting labelled as racist potentially perhaps have some genuine arguments around. So I think on both sides, right, there are some genuine questions, and we've just gone straight into this race-baiting versus race-baiting argument rather than actually a good... Anyway, that's my rant, but I'm waiting for that conversation where we can actually talk about democracy
well,
and
co-governance. To be fair,
stuff
we were waiting for it from Labor, weren't we? And, and I think Chris Hipkins has admitted himself that he didn't enter the debate early enough. And, and again, Jacinda Ardern wasn't really prepared to lay out their case. And if there was one thing that was fair about criticism of co-governance, it was, what does it mean?
Yeah.
And we didn't have a government articulating that clearly.
And Hipkins owning that is interesting. He has actually, you know, said a couple of times now.
He acknowledged that one of his ministers got absolutely monstered as a consequence of him not...
Didn't jump off quick enough.
Not doing enough.
The interesting thing, of course, is that, you know, it's the National Party that did the co-governance arrangement on the Waikato River Authority. It's the National Party that, under Chris Finlayson, that did the deal on the Uruwera, which is a co-governance arrangement. Actually, if you have a look at the Tuhoe settlement, it removes Crown title over the Uruwera.
Yes, and they gave the Waikato River legal personhood.
That's right.
And whanganui.
Which is the old Nixon to China argument, that only Nixon could go to China because the Democrats would have been seen as communists. And often you see that under National, that they are more prepared to give, I don't know, give's the right word, but if you look at Kohanga Reo, for example, or some of the first big treaty settlements under National. Now, I'm not taking away the fight that Māori went through the courts in opposition for many, many years, but it does seem as though the bulk of the Pākehā electorate trusts National not to give too much away to Māori, so they are a little more trusting there. And when Labor does it, people freak out. And so I think that has dogged Labor a little bit.
Yeah.
It was the same under Helen Clark.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Helen Clark had a program called Closing the Gap, and Don Brash launched into that, and they had to flag it away. And now when National
came in,
she
shut it down hard.
She did, because the electorate bounced back on her.
Yeah.
And again, there's a worry that Labor's is getting caught up here, and they're going to give too much away.
Yeah.
And there's
I've heard Labor people saying that they think that's part of their low polls now too, given too much away.
Quite possibly would be. Yet National can do things under the radar that Julian's just mentioned.
Yeah.
A lot of those big treaty settlements, a lot of the co-governance arrangements, and, you know, quite internationally radical things like giving personhood to a river, which I reckon Labor and the Greens would have been laughed out of town for.
Yeah.
There would have been billboards, and they would have been humiliated over it. But Finlayson was able to do it.
And even now, you know, we have the marine laws are often the really interesting ones, whereas there are all kinds of Māori-specific rights in marine laws, including minerals and you know, quite significant wealth-based things there about rights to minerals that Pākehā don't have. But no one, not even ACT, are actually saying we're going to repeal all of this and change it all. So I think, you know, we do get caught up with hyperbole.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the minerals kaupapa, because, you know, it was Abe Nanangato who did that seminal speech, I think it was in Parliament in 1942, I think it was, which talked about the rights of Māori and access to minerals and things of that nature. And don't forget, Ngata was not a Labour man. but you don't hear National talk about that.
I saw a particular politician brandishing one of his books on television.
That's totally right. But the other interesting thing for me is, where did co-governance and this whole thing start from? It started from Three Waters. Why? Because we needed change. Queenstown. Hello? I mean, you know, Waitemata and Auckland Central. Hello?
Havelock North.
And we're caught in this thing. I mean, you know, you've got Wayne Brown, who's having a crack at National over their policy. Okay, they're getting rid of Three Waters. What's next? Hello? You know, we're going through it all now. You know, I know I've been very quick to serve Labor for not being aspirational enough in some areas. It gave co-governance a go. The big backlash really, I think, happened because it was a very strong and ardent and staunch advocate for things Māori and Anaiamahuta, wearing a moko kauai. That was the part that really got people's heckles up, and it still, I think, sits there, even though people don't talk about it as much, save for people like Julian Batchelor in that campaign, but, you know, because they're still using her as their promotion in their promotion material. But, you know, that's
the wrappings,
really where it all came.
The wrappings is important.
I think we're going to share a race we have to deal with.
Yeah, we do. All right, let's run through winners and losers. We've got a few things here which we like to do in our last pre-election episode, which is kind of, you know, wrap up where we
still
think things landed.
I'm back into the election campaign now.
You haven't done this before, brother.
it's all right.
So winners and losers. You started to go there before. So do you want to start with, Julian, you mentioned Malama Davidson, and you asked for a clip for us to play. So let's just play that clip to start this point.
People who are working and earning only low and medium incomes are paying more than twice the effective tax rate of the wealthiest few. And David, it doesn't matter how many poor people may have donated to you. Someone gave you a plane and they want something back for that. And it's not your friendship.
Yeah, look, she's been very strong in just about every debate I've seen her in, and I think she's had a tremendous campaign. Green campaigns actually normally aren't this good. Something normally happens and the wheels fall off. They've had a tremendous campaign, and I think she's been one of the reasons for it. And so for me, she's a star. Now, look, I have to disclose that she's a relation of mine from... So I'm not saying this.
I think you've done this every week, disclose some relation somewhere.
Her brother and I can't stand each other because he supports the Blues and I support the Hurricanes. But she's from Hokianga Whirinaki. She's Awiri Panatene's daughter. She can talk to an audience and she does it really well. And I think they were very strategic in the TVNZ Māori Leaders debate. They put James Shaw up in a much more confined studio environment and then put her in a big public area and she played to that crowd really well. I think she's done really well.
One of the things that keeps coming back to me from the campaign is her and Debbie Naudelpaka in the Power Brokers debate high-fiving. That actually, I don't think that did play well. I thought that looked childish.
Yeah, look, I'll be honest, I didn't see that live. I saw it afterwards. I think, okay, maybe bar that. No one can do 100%, but I think she's had a tremendous campaign. And I said it earlier, and I'll say it again. I think at the end, when you review this campaign, David Seymour and the ACT Party, who have dropped so low in the last few months to only now 8% from 14 or whatever it is, they've had a terrible campaign. And part of it is because of him, because in debates he's been atrocious.
Nice.
You go, Guy.
Well, I'd agree with a lot of what Julian said, actually. For me, the Greens have had a standout campaign. And for me, ACT's biggest problem, apart from... he just overplayed his hand and looked a bit too arrogant. But also, he made that same strategic error, I think, that National did with his talk about, we'd give confidence and not supply, which I think we talked about once, would have been alarming for any business or investor looking at New Zealand. It just looked like a really chaotic sort of solution, and I think he overplayed his hand there.
Yeah.
I think, while we've talked about National strategic errors, I do think Luxon deserves a bouquet for his on-the-ground campaigning. And remember, this is a first-term MP who we thought was going to be really shown up in the campaign, and he probably has lost the odd debate, but he's done pretty well for a first-term MP, and his on-the-ground campaigning and engagement with people has been very, very good. So I think National would be patting themselves on the back for that.
You saw,
and if it
you
had for those strategic errors, I think that they might be polling higher.
There was a clip you saw this week with Luxon on the ground.
Chris Hipkins, frankly, he's the Prime Minister, but he's actually the prime misinformer.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few zingers, aren't they?
I
liked Rawiri Waititi actually in the TVNZ debate. Yeah. They said, would you be comfortable going into opposition? And he said, Māori have been in opposition since 1840.
That was a good one.
So that was quite a good line too.
Yeah. Well, I would say it has to be Lazarus, doesn't it? Winston Peters, the man who has risen up from
Lazarus
nothing.
Peters.
In the sense that...
came down from the north and bestowed himself upon the people.
Came up from the crypt.
Yeah. All of the tiny, tiny little parties that are trying to get over that 5% mark will tell you how incredibly difficult that is.
Oh, look at top.
Yeah. This is a man who has yo-yoed in and out of Parliament, and he's come back from nothing again, and it's not the first time he's done it. So
it's extraordinary.
It's extraordinary that he has managed to do that
with a little bit of help from Chris Luxon
and TikTok. To be honest,
I just to devil's advocate that a little bit. Well, it's been remarkable.
You didn't devil's advocate his choice.
No, I didn't.
Okay, carry on then, Tim.
But it was set up for him, right? This is a campaign where you've got.
Was it set up? Did he manoeuvre himself into that position?
Labour is through two terms and a pandemic and looking pretty tired. National is very inexperienced and, fresh leadership team who are just getting to know the public. We've got the background of a pandemic and a grumpy electorate who are fed up with stuff. That's absolutely made for New Zealand First, isn't it?
Well, it isn't. It is and it isn't, because we've talked about potentially National's strategic missteps.
Sure.
They whacked the ball and then Winston decided what he was going to do. He just lifted his hand up and went, I've got it. And he ran with it. And that is the point. It's not just about what's there and laid out. It's what you do with that.
Sure.
And he worked with it.
He played his hand.
And he played his hand perfectly. And I think particularly this week, when there was some down and out scrapping between the two major parties and name calling and, all the rest of it, he came across as the reasonable elder statesman.
Well, this was one of my... We'd better talk... If you've
whether
got,
it sticks or not, yeah, but that's how we came across this week.
We're going to talk about... So if you've got any other favourite lines, you mentioned the opposition's 80-40, which was a cracker. I quite enjoyed all the lines... All the lines that mentioned long pants and short pants, basically. Oh, there's a lot of talk about pants.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about trousers.
But a lot of trouser talk, which I quite enjoyed about who had the longest pants in the room. Because, you know, Winston was playing his hand so well. I think that you know, was an example of his dexterity, right? He knows how to come through with a line and say, I'm the guy with the long pants, you can trust me.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. Favourite policies, best and worst policies, any policies that stood out in some way that, you know, hurt you or healed you or made you inspired?
The major parties' tax plans have been disastrous.
Yeah.
Labor's GST off fruit and vegetables and National's tax plan, which has more holes in it than a colander. Both of them...
No one believes National's tax plan at all at this point, right? No. And Labor's is just going to make subtle difference is where we've kind of got to, right?
But that gives you an indication of what is driving people's votes as well, if they're not obsessing over numbers and what they're going to get in their back pocket.
Yeah.
It's more about feels at a certain point.
Yeah, that's true. Any particular lines or...?
No. I mean, I thought the Act policy on treaty referendum, no one really actually bought into. And it's hurt him in the end, I think. He overplayed his hand too much on that, and that's why his numbers have started to drop, possibly because of the scenario with Winston as well. But what I hope that says is that people aren't buying into that. Maybe that's just a quirk of the circumstances that we're in. The other policies that I thought worked well for them in the end, though it hasn't shown in the polls of the Māori Party, is they supported the wealth tax, free dental for everyone, not just under 30. Again, those were policies that the Green Party came out with, and I think that's why you see a lot of the left have gone from Labor to the Greens.
Yeah. In terms of the least favourite policies, can we play this clip from Nicola Willis?
Our policy is a more consistent and principled way of ensuring that benefits keep up with the cost of living.
I thought it was a remarkable statement. It's a fascinating policy. This is the de-indexing benefits, right? So the benefits are, the last few years have been going up with wages. National wants to take those, change that so that they go up according to inflation.
When you say benefits, what do you mean?
Not super.
Okay.
Because super's not a real
just
benefit.
Being clear.
It's a pretend benefit that isn't really. It's a benefit when you
well,
it
is
benefit.
In law. It's
it
a
is
benefit.
In law. But yeah.
So one rule for some and one rule for others.
And $2 billion saved over the next 4 years. Which has...
I think that's the key now.
That's the key, right?
You are actually taking money off people. I know that they get very upset
people.
I know, but it's true.
Yeah.
So the poorest people... You can't have it in the savings column if you aren't making a saving.
It's $2 billion that was going to go to people on beneficiaries that will now go in tax cuts to the squeezed middle, including every MP. So that for me was a standout. And to make the argument, I get there's a National Party argument that goes that you want to just get people off benefits because, you know, beneficiary households are where poverty happens. But you know why poverty happens in beneficiary households? Because benefits are so low. Mm. And if you keep them low, you're going to get more poverty. So that, to me, was a striking one, which I'm amazed there almost hasn't been more
fuss
about.
It's been underplayed, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I interviewed Chris Luxon and Rose and brought this point to his attention and said, look, if this is the policy, you will end up losing, or beneficiaries will end up losing $2 billion over 4 years. And he absolutely denied it and then talked about another policy which actually didn't contribute to the conversation at all. So they don't like being pulled up on that point. Mm. There's been accusations that the media hasn't played its role, but in particular with National's tax policy, that it was up to the CTU to start talking about some of the holes in National Party's tax policy. I don't think that's fair. I think there's been a lot of work that's gone on from people raising these issues. But, you know, that's an accusation that's been able to circulate and is going around at the moment, that we haven't done our role good enough, well enough, hard enough. But it's hard for people when they don't want to come on your program, Lisa. If they don't want to come on your program, how are you going to be able to hold them to account? And then when you do get it, you know, and you're told to your face, no, that's not true. And then, you know, pivot. This is the way our politics goes.
For the sake of balance, I should probably say National seems to have really gone big on rehab in prisons, which is interesting. That seems a bit different from previous. So that's, you know, whether they can actually get people into the prisons to do the rehab.
Is that aside from the boot camps?
Yeah, it's aside from the boot camps.
Right.
So, all right.
Seen as Julian is our newest
member
of caucus, I now present you, Julian, with an envelope and an official piece of paper. And what we do with this is you need to write your predictions for the outcome of the election in terms of percentages.
Where are my
scrutiny
ears? Where are my
scrutiny
ears?
There you go.
If you're, watching on YouTube, Lisa is now scolding Guy and slapping his hand.
Okay. And so don't show us. Write down your numbers and its percentages.
Okay.
I hate put it in your envelope. Put your name on it so that we know who to mock after we open them.
It's me. It's always me.
And then just for the interest of all the eagle-eyed people, when you seal it properly, Julian, yes. You sign your name across the seal so that we know
okay,
if you've done bad things. And, I mean, Tim wanted to write us with a pencil, which is just totally unacceptable because it could lead to post-match changes. Guyan's Mr. Technology. He's got his on his phone. I've got mine on a very bedraggled piece of paper. And Tim is not even sure that his maths adds up.
No, but, you I can't count. First rule of politics, right? Learn to count. Six and
everybody's okay, diligently scribbling away, trying to hide it from each other.
For the sake of our audience,
it doesn't make great radio.
Here we are. Hang on, just double check if you've written your right numbers down.
Tim's adds up to 117.
I know. Putting it in the envelope now.
My apologies to my
There's a fiscal hole in
things. Yeah, I know. Putting it in there. Seal your envelopes, please.
Wait, they've got to add up to 100.
Let's do this after. I feel we need to put the listeners out of their misery and let them go. Because the audience needs to get on with their lives. Lisa, as always, is the most organised.
And Guy is fine. Sign your seal.
Okay. Right.
So that we know he's like that we haven't broken it up.
Let me
when do we open these, Tim?
We open these next Thursday. So there's one more episode of Caucus to go.
Oh, and what's the prize for the person who gets closest to the numbers?
Toblerone.
Okay, is that
enough?
What's the second prize?
Foreign Minister? Or is Foreign Minister already taken? We will talk to you all again, whether you're watching on YouTube, listening on a podcast. It's been great to have your company this campaign. We'll wrap all this up, talk about tides and coalitions and things are going to happen next Thursday. Tune in then from
Guyan Espiner,
Lisa Owen,
Julian Wilcox,
and me, Tim Watkin. See you next week.
Give me your envelope.
Please go vote.
I've got to make sure mine is.
Sign it. You've got to sign it across.
Hang on.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.